This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of February 23rd, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 384. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest, I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker, and on the big deal feature, after a nine-month hiatus, including the fall election, the 43rd Parliament of British Columbia is now in session. The NDP government heralded a Trump trade war-themed throne speech, but John Rustad's conservative opposition came to grill Premier David Eby about BC's ongoing fentanyl crisis. My guest is Fran Yenner from Northern Beat. This is the big deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. February 18th in Victoria, new Lieutenant Governor Wendy Kochia read a war-themed throne speech to begin a new session at the legislature.
We open this first session of British Columbia's 43rd Parliament at the most consequential time for our province since the Second World War. In the face of an unprecedented and unjustified threat to our economy, British Columbians are joining with all Canadians to fight back. We've come together to support each other and stand up for our country. We are saying with one united voice, we will never be the 51st state, not now or ever.
NDP Premier David Eby later explained why.
This is going to be the issue of the session. It is the issue of primary concern for so many British Columbian and Canadian families.
The 44-member Conservative caucus gave the 47-seat NDP its first two question period tests in the new 93-seat legislature. Joining me on the podcast is one of the reporters who covers the legislature and has broken some important stories on public safety and social services, Fran Yenner, publisher of northernbeat.ca. Fran joined me for the first part of her interview from the outside of the Parliament buildings on February 19th. I started by asking Fran about all the new MLAs elected last fall.
Any funny stories of people getting lost in the legislature or in their first turn in question period? What's the general situation there with some of these newbies?
I think it's the speaker that was helping them guide them along today in the first question period of the session. One, for instance, jumped up sort of for supplemental for the getting introduced. I mean, it's sort of a small thing, but everything is very, very procedural, as you know, in the chamber. And the speaker was like, oh, I got to introduce you before you can talk. And another one sort of jumped up with her supplemental and very dissatisfied with the answer from a minister and sort of answered him without actually asking a second question. So just things that are, you don't realize how many rules are involved. Anyway, it's a big learning curve for all these new MLAs, and a lot of them are from the north and rural, as you know, the blue wave. So a lot of new faces. Like in terms of the press gallery, it was pretty full, and we're passing a lot around the map of the new members because there's so many new faces, we don't know who everyone is. So trying to match up the faces with the seats and the ridings. So we all have the seating maps and figure out who's talking at different times. Interesting.
Now, there's also a new face in the throne on the throne speech day. Of course, the speech is written by the government and read by the Lieutenant Governor, the representative of the Queen. This one was heavy on the World War II references, light on policy previews, all seemingly shaped by geopolitics, the Trump-Trudeau tariff tiff. And afterwards, David Eby said, this is going to be the issue of the session.
That's certainly the question around here. The opposition obviously has its opinion on that. Rustad thinks that it's a deflection from the actual issues. And certainly the throne speech was very light on details, which throne speeches can be. But this one was, I understand, a little bit lighter than usual. And didn't really introduce anything new, like on, as you say, those sort of the issues that are really matter to people and the issues that the NDP frankly got slapped down on during the election, which is, you know, crime, public safety, addictions, healthcare, and the economy. And so nothing really in the throne speech addressing that, and as, but lots of sort of war imagery and rah-rah Canada messaging in there. So I guess time will tell.
The Solicitor General, Gary Begg, the Health Minister, Josie Osborne, they held a very short notice news conference and to announce a bit of a change in the way that prescriptions are doled out, the so-called safe supply drugs. No more take home. They now have to take them in front of a pharmacist. Do you think that this is a viable solution at all?
Well, it's certainly an improvement from what was happening prior, which is unwitnessed and sort of fettered proliferation of safe supply on the black market. And as you know, the government just recently conceded that it, well, actually a year ago, the police indicated that it was part of organized crime, that the drugs had made their way into organized crime and part of the business model. And then 2 weeks ago, the leak report indicated that diversion was now an international issue and that the safe supply is being trafficked provincially, nationally, and internationally. So we still have no details on that because the government won't give any details. But one of the things the opposition has been calling for, and doctors, addiction doctors have been calling for years, is at the very, very least, they're usually calling for a pause in the program, but at the very least witnessed. So this is a step in the right direction. But one thing to remember is that Safe Supply was introduced in D.C. in March 2020. It had never been implemented in this manner anywhere else in the world ever. So there was no evidence from the very beginning that this program will work. They keep saying that it works, but they have no scientific evidence that it does. Safe supply or prescribed alternatives. Some of these drugs can be used when they're administered in a medical setting as part of a medical plan. Like Alberta has safe supply, but the patients have to go in. A doctor administrates it. They have goals and outcomes. They're not just like perpetually on safe supply. They have health plans. Like, you know, in 3 months, they have to be in a new place. Like, it's about easing them off drugs. It's used kind of like out. Whereas here, it's just freely distributed. So the program is flawed from the very, very beginning. And I mean, the question that I have is, if this was implemented, it's never been done like this before, ever, globally. They had no evidence it would work. What's the legal liability? Because now it's been almost 5 years with addictions doctors, certainly, I mean, doing open ads since 2021, warning of the diversion. Like, what's the legal liability for the government to have implemented this and then not paid attention, at the very least, to warnings coming that it was being diverted? It's an open question.
And it became the top topic in the first question period of this new session of the legislature.
I would say surprises, and the Conservatives have said they're pushing for a public inquiry. Essentially, John Ross has said they want to know what was known and when. Because the government, Josie Osborne, the health minister, again today in her press conference said government learned about diversion last year and it acted right away. And as I said, you know, the first op-ed that I remember reading from an addictions doctor was in 2021, warning about diversion. And I've since talked to so many addictions doctors, most of them off the record because they didn't want to be canceled or criticized or have their reputation spread for speaking against safe supply. There's a huge, huge concern in the medical community about how it was being applied. And, you know, to think that the system didn't know about it before last year. So the Greens released a statement just after the health minister announced the change, and they are quite concerned about the move to witnessed, because it will restrict people's access to safe supply and cause some people to not be able to consume it. Some of them are not comfortable going to having to go there several times a day. There's certainly some advocates that have said that also. They're against witnessed, going full on witnessed. So it's a huge thing, because you think about it. Some people, according to like what has been seized by the police, they're getting like 28 pills a day. So I don't know how you administer that. So it had to be administered several times a day. So people would have to come in several times a day. I think it's going to be this massive burden on pharmacists. I don't know. I think it's going to be chaotic, and it's a real just sort of administrative reason that they've resisted probably doing this also. And you certainly can't cut people off. For the people that genuinely were taking it, which we don't know how many were. A lot of people were just selling it for fentanyl, which has been proven in several states. But we don't know how many people were actually just consuming it, and some people were.
Do you think that there might be any resistance from the pharmacists themselves?
I think it's going to be onerous. And at the same time, Josie Osborne also mentioned reducing the fees that pharmacists can get for dispensing or something. I wasn't clear on that. It's always sort of light on details, but to dissuade, you know, the some of the fraud that was happening in terms of pharmacists disincentivizing the system from wanting to divert the drugs. So I don't know if that's like a double whammy for pharmacists. They start getting less money and then they have all this extra work. I mean, think about it. Like, even if, you know, 28 pills a day, how many disbursements is that? And a day, or even if it, like, the average maybe is less pills than that, maybe 20 pills. How many times a day does a person have to go in and get witnessed? And then in some of these areas that are, you know, have a lot, like downtown east side, how do those pharmacies handle the stream of patients? I think this is going to be a bit of a nightmare.
Will this new opposition, very large opposition, does John Rustad have what it takes to keep them together as a team?
Well, Rustad and some of the members, the MLAs on the opposition that I've spoken to, certainly seem keen to go hard and to hold the government's feet to the fire on tough issues. I think we're going to see them talking about some of the things that they talked about in the election. They're just going to continue and to hit on what they perceive as government's vulnerabilities. And government is going to do as government does, which is defend itself and go on the offensive a bit himself. Like Evie goes on the offensive himself too. He pushed back on safe supply today in question period, saying that government is doing its best. Josie Osborne said, "As soon as we hear, we're doing everything we can. We want citizens to know that we're doing everything we can to protect them." Evie says they're making these changes to protect the general public from diversion, even though some people will be harmed that are on the safe supply program, because they won't be able to, it'll be more inconvenient for them to go. So he says that he's balancing the two. And I think that's we're going to see more of the same, but we're going to see a lot of tough issues. I think that it's going to be a very, very lively, interesting session. There's quite a variety of personalities, as there always is in a caucus, but John Rustad's going to have his hands full. He seems calm as ever, though, so I don't know. his team and talking to some of the people that work with him, I think they're trying to get a handle on how to keep everyone together. I don't think anyone really knows how it's going to roll out. When he said everyone gets to share their opinion and everyone has free votes, it's a very kind of refreshing thought, not to be whipped into the vote, but how do you do that in practice? It's especially when so many of them are so new. There's something, you know, to learning how to play on a team, but also having your free vote. There's going to be a lot of tensions there that will be very interesting for all of us to watch, because of course you, I, other journalists, and the public who tunes in will be watching that with great interest.
Conservative leader John Rustad and public safety critic Eleanor Sturco aggressively targeted the NDP in question period about the fentanyl crisis. But two rookie MLA surprises emerged. Skeena MLA Claire Rattay and Chilliwack Cultus Lake MLA Elia Warbus, who is also the Conservative House leader. They had the NDP on their heels when they revealed how the fentanyl crisis had changed their lives. Here is Claire Rattay on February 19th.
Member for Skeena.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. While this NDP premier was saying that diversion wasn't happening, his government knew that the police were investigating. Then Minister of Mental Health and Addiction said, quote, "I would say again that I have not heard directly a concern from law enforcement or seen evidence from law enforcement of safe supply being diverted," end quote. To the Premier, through you, Mr. Speaker, will he finally admit that the NDP's safe supply program has failed and it has only fueled BC's drug crisis?
Premier.
Because we have been engaged in this work together, the Association of Chiefs of Police issued a statement today stating that they recognize the importance of harm reduction measures, including safe supply and addressing the ongoing toxic drug crisis, and noting with approval the move by the province to move to witness ingestion, saying, quote, "It is equally essential that these programs are structured in a way that prevents unintended consequences, including the illegal redistribution of prescribed substances." We agree entirely. That's why we've taken the step of moving to witness ingestion. It's a challenging decision because we know it'll limit access of some people to the program, but it's a necessary step, and glad to have the support of the police in taking this step.
14 years ago, I was a homeless addict living on the downtown east side. And I can tell you that the people that are going to die today and tomorrow deserve better than that answer.
Here is Elia Warbus on February 20th.
Opposition House Leader.
Respectfully, my family has already paid an unsurmountable price during this crisis. Not only did it take two of my brothers, but also my niece, who died alone in a tent in one of the tent cities from an overdose by herself. And just last fall, we buried my 13-year-old nephew because he found a wallet with drugs in it, which he did that night in his bed while his mom slept in the next room. And he was not an addict. We're not alone in this. We know that 16,328 people have died. Do not round the numbers down when you're talking about lives. 16,328 families that will not get their loved ones back, their children, their parents, and their spouses. Our children and our youth are our future, and they are dying because of this crisis. Again, Mr. Speaker, to the Premier, will you call a public inquiry to expose who knew what, when? Be truly transparent and accountable to the family members and the communities that deserve to know, and prevent the massive loss of precious life that we are experiencing as a community and as British Columbians.
Minister of Health.
Thank you, Honourable Speaker. And once again, the government or the opposition House Leader is revealing very personal details around the impact on her family. And I want to acknowledge that this crisis has touched Indigenous peoples in particular in a very disproportionate way, and that the trauma that Indigenous people have lived with and the difficulty of accessing healthcare altogether is all part of this, and why we have to stay focused on the work that we are doing with everybody to support them.
Fran Yenner joined me again on February 20th to analyze Rattay and Warbus.
Well, first I want to describe how they, how these two, Warbus and Rattay, came across. They were actually, as you say, they were quite a surprise, remarkably poised and forceful, both of them. There's a tenacity there that I think the NDP should be paying attention to. Warbus stood up today. She led the questioning today, which is unusual. I mean, she's newly elected. She led the questioning in the second question period of the session, and she's the House leader. Let's just think about that for a moment. She talked about having lost two brothers and a niece who died in a tent city. And then most recently, a 13-year-old nephew who discovered some pills and took them in his mother's, you know, in his family home. So very, very personal stories of loss that just, I think, it's certainly, I think everyone was almost holding their breath when she spoke, because she was very clear, very precise, not a wasted word, but so powerful and full of emotion, actually. It was, you know how question periods can sometimes descend into a bit of a circus atmosphere, not the case at all, sort of a stark honesty. And the NDP were listening. How can you not listen? And Osborne stood up, the health minister, Josie Osborne, stood up and responded, expressing her, you know, sympathy, empathy. But clearly her response was a defense of the government and how they I don't know, I can't remember exactly what Osborne said. It's talking about staying focused and working hard and doing our best. Clearly not a response that went over well with Warbus. I think she was a real surprise. And then yesterday, Claire Rattay, again, also another powerful performance in the chamber, holding David Eby to account specifically for the harms of Safe Supply and asking for an inquiry. And then her also quite dissatisfied with David Eby's response, ending, and she actually ended her supplemental question with a very dramatic statement that what he said wasn't good enough for the people that are going to die today and die tomorrow. And then she sat down. It was quite quite confident, impassioned appearances or I don't want to say performance, because quite passionate questioning by both of these new MLAs, unusually poised, as I said.
Yeah, and this is also interesting because of who they are. You know, the NDP has tried to paint itself as the party of diversity, the party of feminism. You know, they're the party that claims to own all that, and they try to paint the conservatives as being just this bunch of right-wingers, these Trumpists. But these two MLAs show that that's not the case, that this is a kind of a different version of the conservatives, one that people weren't quite expecting.
Yeah, they both have these deeply meaningful experiences and connection to the drug overdose crisis, frankly. Warbus, as you know, she's Indigenous and she's lost all these family members very close to her. And Rattay said that she used to live in the downtown east side and was deeply addicted for a few years. You combine that with the frontline experience of Eleanor Sturco as a former police officer on the front lines, and conservatives have a powerhouse team on this file, and they don't look to be laying off anytime soon. And then also John Rusted, as you said, Rusted and Sterko were predicted, but they both were quite strong today. Rusted came out demanding an inquiry, saying the public had a right to know who knew what when. Given that the public was funding government international drug trafficking. And as Sterko had a particularly powerful line, she said, somebody knew this was happening and they did nothing. So I think this is going to dominate question period for a while yet. I mean, the NDP made this change to say supply last second. We got the email about, about the announcement about an hour before. And just before they were also going to head in for their first question period, this looked like it was a sort of last ditch attempt to deflect attention and minimize the questioning. But I don't think it's done that at all.
Fran Yenner, publisher of northernbeat.ca.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In focus, Taiwan.tw. Canadian frigate transits Taiwan Strait on February 16th. The Halifax-class frigate Ottawa's transit was the first by a Canadian vessel this year and the sixth one involving Canada after the country released its Indo-Pacific strategy in November 2022. The transit demonstrated Canada's commitment to upholding peace and freedom in the Strait, which is international waters, Taiwan's Ministry of Foreign Affairs said. In Kyoto news, Japan asks Taliban to respect human rights during talks in Tokyo. The first known visit to Japan by members of the hardline Islamist group since its takeover of Afghanistan in 2021. The officials of the Taliban regime, which is not recognized by Japan as Afghanistan's official government, arrived on Sunday night at the invitation of the Nippon Foundation, a non-profit grant-making organization based in Tokyo. In ABC News Australia, Australian security intelligence organization boss reveals multiple nations plotted to murder critics in Australia. ASIO has foiled plots by hostile foreign nations to assassinate or harm critics in Australia. The spy agency's boss also expressed fears in his annual threat assessment that anti-Semitic attacks had not yet plateaued. Attacks on Jewish Australians feared to continue and sabotage by foreign states a rising concern for ASIO. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In the Oregonian, Oregon farm worker wins damages in unusual discrimination case after company hired foreign laborers. A federal jury has awarded Madras man Virgilio Carvajal $190,000 for emotional distress and $17,000 for lost wages after finding that Oregon-based Cal Farms violated his rights by hiring temporary foreign workers over him, a qualified U.S. citizen, for seasonal fieldwork. In Crosscut, Washington sheriffs respond to Trump's immigration enforcement plans. Cascade PBS and Investigate West surveyed all 39 counties' chief law officers on how they plan to balance conflicting state and federal laws. The majority of Washington sheriffs said they would focus their resources on public safety and local laws, not federal immigration enforcement. Washington's sanctuary law restricts the extent to which local law enforcement agencies may participate in federal immigration enforcement. And check out thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com for the stories behind these headlines. Trudeau nearing the exit, but could he still face charges over the SNC-Lavalin scandal? And Carney downplays Canada's fentanyl epidemic. Read the stories behind the headlines. Go to thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate, so you won't.
Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to West Vancouver's Sam Reinhardt and Abbotsford's Devon Taves, as well as Coach John Cooper, who hails from Prince George. The British Columbia contingent on Canada's Four Nations Cup winning team, which beat the U.S. in an overtime thriller on February 20th. Canada needed a reason to celebrate something. This team delivered. Hey Trump, it's Canadian hockey great again. And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar? Send me an email to bob at thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of February 23rd, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 23rd of February in 1909, the experimental aircraft called the Silver Dart flew almost a kilometer in Baddeck, Nova Scotia? Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob at thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. And introducing bobmackin.substack.com. Visit me there too. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. Or follow The Breaker News for news as it happens on X, formerly Twitter. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $7 a month. For more information, go to bobmackin.substack.com. Until next week.